Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, as delighted as can be to be here with you on a Friday when we've got two fantastic guests. Recently, there's a document from the Vatican, and to speak colloquially, we don't have to get into the office and all that, and it's called Dignitas Infinita. I think I'm pronouncing it wrong. And people talk about these and go, we got a perfect guest to talk about it. Philosopher, theologian, priest, Father Sebastian Walsh. What's in the document? How do you read a document like this? What should we make of it? If you've been hearing things and reading things and you just want someone who's just perfect as far as being prepared and also just having the temperament to read church documents, we'll do that the second hour. So maybe you got questions about Dignitas Infinita, or however it's pronounced, and you can do that second hour. This hour, we're going to talk about the church in the news. J.D. Flynn is here with us, and if you've got questions about things that are happening in the Catholic Church, things you're reading about, things you're seeing on TV, reading about in social media, whatever, J.D. Flynn is here to take your calls and your questions, and if you don't call, I'm just going to talk with him, because I love talking with J.D. He's a canon lawyer. He's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Pillar, which you can find at pillarcatholic.com. And you should. It's a wonderful journalism project focused on the life of the church. It really has become the go-to source for lots of people for journalism regarding the life of the church. J.D. previously worked in diocesan administration, and you worked as a seminary professor of canon law too, huh? Hi, J.D.
I love teaching seminarians. Yeah. Not that they're just good folks.
You're good folks, and all you guys at the Pillar are good folks. But we never thought we'd be featured there, and we're not going to talk about that yet. But you all did a story about us. We will get to that
later. I never thought I'd do a story about you. Yeah.
No, I. One thing I have learned about the news is don't be in it. That's a good policy.
It's better to write about it than to be written about, that's for sure.
Don't be in it. If you can avoid being in it, your life's going to be better. The number here is 888-318-7884. Are there things about the life of the church, the news of the church that you'd like to talk about today? J.D. Flynn here to talk with you. 888-318-7884. I want to start with a happy story, if I may.
Great.
And it's by your own Luke Coppin.
And that's probably great.
It's about France, and we had a French bishop visit us a few years ago here, and I remember kind of making some kind of joke about French Catholicism, you know, like a little teasing comment, and he said, you know, he goes, don't count out French Catholicism. He said there's signs of renewal that you might be surprised about. And that's what Luke recently reported on, Luke Coppin recently reported on, this group that's going around kind of restoring crucifixes and little chapels and whatnot around France. And the young people want to do it. They want to restore their Christian heritage.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a very, very cool story. You're right. This is a movement called the SOS. I'm not going to pronounce it right because it's French, but Calvaries, the Saving Calvaries, basically. And what they are is a movement of young people who restore these sort of roadside little chapels or little shrines or little crosses that are all over the place in rural France and all over the place in rural Europe. You can see them. But in France, many of them were destroyed during the French Revolution. And then those that survived, many of them have just been neglected for decades, and especially as the practice of Catholicism in France has declined, but most especially as France has urbanized and people have moved out of rural areas and more frequently into cities, these rural roadside shrines, which are quite beautiful, have kind of been neglected and begun to decline. And so these young people go around and they'll have a kind of service day where they will restore them, and maybe it'll take some time. They'll get some woodworkers and things like that to restore them, repaint them, clean up the area around them, and it's beautiful to sort of see this growing in France.
Yeah, and I guess the narrative is just so negative, and I think there's a reason that it's negative. You know, that if you go to Sunday Mass in many parts of Europe, you'd be almost alone. I mean, there'll be a few people there, and you'll be almost alone. But maybe there's a point at which it stops being interesting to leave the church and starts being interesting to reconsider the church, and people start giving it its reconsideration.
Yeah, I think that's right. We did a different story about France back in March, and it was about the kind of boom in adult baptisms in France. So in 2024, 7,135 people, more than 7,000 people who were adults were baptized in France. And that's a big increase. It's an increase of 30% from 2023. And this is part of a trend that we've seen over the past couple of years where adult baptisms are just climbing and climbing and have been since basically 2019. And this means, of course, that, you know, it is true that fewer babies are baptized in France, that more people choose not to baptize their baby because they don't practice the faith. But there is a growing number of people who find the faith as adults, and largely it seems through new ecclesial movements. So there are kind of two centers of energy in the life of the church in France and in some of the other European countries. One is traditionalism, people who love the extraordinary form of the Mass, the traditional Latin Mass, and the other is a kind of flourishing of ecclesial movements like the Neocatechumenal Way or Communion and Liberation, Opus Dei even, and then some smaller groups as well, which have begun really re-evangelizing parts of France where many young people have never heard the gospel at all.
Yeah, because that's an extraordinary thing as an adult to receive baptism. This is not just a casual interest. This is not just a, every now and then you drop in. This is people who are again taking the faith seriously after so many losses for the faith, generation after generation in France. And Luke mentioned that in this latest story as well, and several other things, and then mentioned that the Olympics will be there this summer. There'll be the reopening and rededication of Notre Dame Cathedral, and so there'll be a little bit of attention on France. And I guess the idea is, don't be surprised if you see that there is actually a Catholic faith that's alive, if not thriving in the sense of huge percentages of the population, thriving in the sense of the numbers are going up, not down.
Yeah, that's quite right. So a friend told me about a story, not about France, but about Spain. He was in Spain with his family for Holy Week, and they went to Mass, they went to Easter Vigil, and they thought they'd be the only family there. It was in the crypt of Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, and they thought they'd be the only family there. And at first they were, but sort of little by little as the Mass began, families kind of trickled in. And by the end, the number was about double the size of the congregation that was there when the vigil began. And I thought maybe that was a good sort of illustration of the way in which people are sort of trickling, not in these huge waves, but people are trickling back into the life of the church in European countries where I think many people thought that the practice of the faith would only continue to decline.
Well, I have to maybe juxtapose that a bit with some of the statistical reporting you do. And really, one of the things that you guys are really good at, I think, at The Pillar is looking at numbers, whether it's financial numbers, whether it's, church attendance numbers, baptism numbers. Like, you get the numbers tell a story with you guys in a way that in many places it would be more anecdotal. But the numbers are not good in the United States, as far as it's not just not good, JD. Sometimes I read these articles and I think, oh my gosh, there's a lot for us to be worried about.
Yes, by the numbers, the church is experiencing a precipitous decline in the life of the United States. That is true, and there's no way around that. And that means a number of things. That means fewer infant baptisms in the United States, fewer confirmations, fewer people getting married, far fewer people being ordained. It means that our clergy, you know, we're on the sort of precipice of both about one third of our diocesan bishops kind of reaching retirement age over the next few years, and about the same size of our priests kind of reaching retirement age over the next few years. So yes, the U.S. is by any number of statistical metrics facing not only sort of decline in religious practice, which I think we knew, but sort of infrastructural and institutional decline. And we can document that with the numbers. What we can't document with the numbers, what I always try and tell people is, we think it is important to know what the numbers show. We think it is important to have our eyes open about kind of what the the data reality is, but only really so that we can be looking to see what God is doing. And that's the part that we can't document with numbers. But I think if we're believers, then we have to say that at a time where we see statistical decline, we also have to be looking for the places where God is moving and the ways that renewal might, you know, begin in the church as well.
And it is interesting, and we'll take a break in a second here and then let people ask you questions. We're talking about the church in the news. J.D. Flynn is our guest from The Pillar, and you should check out their work. Just put in Pillar Catholic or The Pillar in your search bar. You'll find them, and they do wonderful
work. PillarCatholic.com. Check us out.
Or just go to PillarCatholic.com. And when we look at these numbers and when we, and like you said, when we then ask that question, what is God doing? It does seem that, even you mentioned it with France, that these new movements that came up in the 20th century are, at whether liberal or conservative or however you want to describe them, the new movements are actually a source of life now in the church. They are having a tremendous effect.
Yeah, they are. They are. So the kind of ecclesial movements which mostly began to flourish in the pontificate of John Paul II, and I think the most prominent example in the United States is probably communion. Is probably the neocatechumenal way, which has seminaries and priests all across the country, but other movements as well. They are centers of life in the church. The biggest concentrations of young people in many parts of the church are either, again, there's sort of these two poles, either in movements like Communion and Liberation, which is, sort of very something which has emerged only in recent decades, or a growing number of young people who are interested in sort of the traditional Latin Mass and things like that. But those things have common things in common characteristic, I think, and most especially these really sort of thick social bonds of community that are not just sort of seeing people at Mass. Survey after survey says that what people feel most despondent about in their life as a Catholic, or what they struggle with the most in their life as a Catholic, is not clerical sexual abuse scandals or clerical financial abuse scandals or sort of doctrinal mealy-mouthedness, but a feeling of being alone, of not being known at their parish, and of not being known by their pastor. And so these movements or pockets that have sort of thick bonds of community are the places where the church is just attracting people very quickly. Now, those movements are also growing up, and as they grow up, like the religious orders of the medieval world, or the missionary orders of the post-Reformation era, as they get into their sort of second and third generation of leadership, they have some growing pains, and they have to kind of work with the Holy See. Sometimes it's easy to do, sometimes it's not easy to do, to work with the Holy See to make sure that they have kind of a healthy leadership culture, a healthy formation culture. And I think we'll see that in some of these movements over the next couple of years, some issues related to their leadership and formation kind of being meted out. But those are signs of vitality, too, that the thing has enough legs for those things to need to be addressed.
888-318-7884 is the number. We're talking the church in the news. J.D. Flynn is our guest. Your calls welcome, whether you're Catholic or not. 888-318-7884.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
He is honored by the church as a saint and the first diocesan priest to be declared a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. John of Avila was known to his contemporaries as a spiritual master, and he served as a guide to some of the greatest saints of the 1500s. He also called for true reform in the church and was a role model for the priesthood even today. He died in 1569.
To find out more, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. J.D. Flynn is our guest, and you should check out Ed Condon and J.D.'s work and all the folks. One of the wonderful things that's happening over there is you have more and more contributors there. I suppose that's a healthy sign of your growth. At The Pillar, you can check it out at pillarcatholic.com. I don't know, a lot of people are checking it out. A lot of people are using you as the source now for their...
Yeah, we're very blessed. I mean, as far as we can tell, we are one of the most trafficked news websites in the Catholic news websites in the world, and we feel very blessed by that and very, very grateful for people who read us and who look to our reporters for a sense of what's happening in the life of the church. And really, we are just trying to... The whole of our project is that we love the church, and we want to take the church seriously, both in terms of what she claims sort of theologically and as a human institution. And we try and cover that as well, as smart and as serious as we can, and have some fun while we're doing it.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. Is there some way for you as a journalist to kind of know what are the big Catholic stories in the world at any given time? Like, is there a way to kind of search and go, what's the big Catholic news this week or over the last 30 days or something?
It's so funny that you say that, Ty, because that's always the challenge, right? It's how do we know what's going on outside of our own sort of spheres of contact or spheres of engagement?
Right.
And because I wanted that for myself, we asked our senior correspondent, a guy named Luke Coppin, to produce a little daily news summary for us called Starting Seven. And I don't know if you get Starting Seven,
yeah,
site, but it tells me every single day what's happening all around the world in the life of the church. It takes me about 10 minutes to read. And after my brief read, it's the first thing I read every day. And it's designed to do exactly what you're describing.
So what would you say, over the last, 30 days? What's a big story in the church? Maybe something nobody saw coming that just popped up and got reported all around the world. Anything come to mind?
That's a hard question. Which one comes to, what story comes to mind for you?
Father Justin. I was trying to get you to say it. And you're like being polite.
Father Justin. Gosh. What a beautiful, I mean, a short priesthood, but every priesthood is a beautiful priesthood. So what a short and beautiful priesthood.
A short priesthood. All right. So, I'm just curious, because I know what happened on our end, but there you are sitting in your office. How do you go, this is on the radar now. We got to pay attention to this. Like when something like that happens.
Well, what we know that something is going to be of interest to a lot of people when our phones start blowing up.
Oh.
So I can't tell you, after you guys launched the Father Justin Catholic Answers AI apologetics robot priest, I started getting just so many texts from people, lay people, priests, religious, bishops, all saying, like, did you see this thing? And each with their own viewpoint on it, but I thought, okay, this is going to be the kind of thing that people want to pay attention to. So I reached out to Catholic Answers, and I asked if I could do an interview about it, and I thought it was a really good conversation in which I learned more about what you guys were doing. And what I think is what I appreciated about that is I like that Catholic Answers, and I'm not saying this for any reason except I think it's true, I like that Catholic Answers is entrepreneurial and tries new things. Now, you know, I think you guys have heard all the other viewpoints on it, but I will say I like that you try new things, and I know that's what you were going for there.
Well, why did you hear criticisms? I hadn't heard. I hadn't heard any. We all had fun with John Sorensen's interview he did with you, because he kept saying for one thing, you got to love working for a boss who takes all the blame himself, who goes, this was me,
right,
this was mine, I decided, yeah. And even if it's not entirely true, he took the hit for everybody, and then he kept saying, I just got to take my lumps. And I think you even put that in the headline.
He said that, I think, four times in our story, so I had to put it as the headline.
Yeah.
Well, and he took them. I mean, you know, Father Justin probably. And the cool thing about Father Justin is he sort of has been a unifying force in American Catholicism, because just about every tribe of American Catholics has
hated him,
has had a view, shall we say, on Father Justin.
Well, he's not Father Justin anymore. And
then, of course,
the jokes started and it went around the world. I mean, I saw the headline, robot priest laicized. I saw it in Indian newspapers, in British newspapers, in the New York newspapers. That's a pretty hard headline to resist.
Well, somebody said to me that in the spirit of laicized priests everywhere, he's probably going to marry the robot parish DRE and then kind of show up back up in the parish again after that. So we'll see. We'll see what the future holds for Father Justin.
But I you know, we one of the real beauties of this for us is we've gotten to speak with very interesting people who are in the world of AI, reached out to us, and also some folks in the church who have been thinking about how to make use of these things. Some of whom are critics, some of whom are cheerleaders, but it's actually a very interesting conversation. And I wonder, and you whatever you say, it's fine. We've taken every kind of criticism, but do you think that? I do think it was entrepreneurial to give it a shot, and. But is this something that the church is going to have to figure out how to use, or is it something that, in your view, we're just going to have to stay away from? And I don't mean Father Justin, I just mean the AI stuff in general.
Yeah, from my point of view, I am pretty cautious about kind of these large language learning models for two reasons. One, yours actually got, you know, to its credit, got a lot of questions right, and I tried to throw it some sort of curveballs, and it didn't hit all the curveballs, but it hit a surprising number of them. But you know, if you kind of play around with ChatGPT or things like that, you realize a lot of the time these models are just pulling things out of the air, and so it's hard to know what's true and what isn't. And I think, you know, people have talked about us that we're living in a sort of post-truth world in which, for a lot of reasons, it's hard to know what's true and what isn't and what the value of truth is. And Benedict, of course, you know, warned us about the dictatorship of relativism. And I think one thing to learn to be most kind of concerned about is not the anthropomorphization of the things, but just this question of, do they make it harder for us to get at something which is already very difficult for us to get at in the contemporary world, which is truth. Mm-hmm. You know, lots of ideologues want to sort of spin truth into something which is, you know, which befits their own narrative, and we have to be cautious about that. And then when we're sort of using models which, because of their deficits of their programming and their limits of their capacity and stuff, just will frequently say things which aren't true, you know, without any malice, but just because of the way they're designed, does that make it harder for us to even just believe that we can know the truth? And if we become despondent about the question of whether we know that we're in the truth, will we enter into sort of a deeper cultural existential crisis about whether the truth can even be known?
Yeah,
that's what concerns me. So I don't know. I mean, on the other hand, a lot of kids find them helpful for their term papers, I guess.
Yeah, so. They do. And I, frankly, organizations like yours are using them to write the news stories. I'll go to ESPN or something to read about a basketball game, and you realize that a computer can write a perfectly good article it'll tell you it'll get the statistics in the right place. It'll take the quotes from the press conference and the little interviews they do after and put them all in the right place. So it's kind of freaky.
It's true, but it's really interesting because a computer can write a perfectly serviceable article about basketball game. You're right. It can kind of take the box score and it can and turn that into a narrative, and it can then take things from the press conference and all that. But it can do that and at the same time miss the game entirely, miss that the entire game turned around because of some monster block, or that the game – you know, that the team built momentum after being on an 8-game losing streak, and like beating this team at this time could be the thing that really turns around their season. Like the stuff that comes from, cognition can be missed entirely. And so we just get a very sort of thin account of things, even when we get an accurate one. That's what I feel like at ESPN.com all the time now. It's like, I could have just read the box score because I read the write-up, but I didn't learn anything about like the game. And sometimes like, somebody's line for the game, like, okay, they almost had a double-double, but they didn't, like, but sometimes, like, you need to hear what was going on in the game to understand the statistics about their play. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. Yeah, you're right. It's serviceable, but it's not the same. It's not. And I tried it several times using ChatGPT because we do a game show here. And so I got to come up with 20 good questions for the game show. And so I just ask it, give me 100 multiple choice questions about, Catholics and Protestants or something. And I'll tell you, I'll go through those 100 multiple choice questions, and often there's not even two or three that are usable for me. And then, and maybe the way that I do the query, but even those I have to rewrite in order to make them kind of, you know, I don't know, have a little bit of bounce to them, a little something that makes them interesting on the air.
That's right. Yeah. So it can be kind of thin because I mean, the whole model is a model of predictive text, right? What do I expect that something would say based on this text I've consumed? Well, if everything is predictive text, then it's boring because it's repeating old tropes and cliches by design, right? So there's nothing sort of new or insightful there.
The number here, 888-318-7884. We'll get to callers for JD, and I got more news stories to ask him about. JD Flynn is our guest, and we're talking about the news of the church in the world, or the news of the world as it affects the church, whatever, however you want to construct that. If you want to ask JD, call 888-318-7884.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Are you scared to talk about abortion? Don't worry, almost everyone is. You can overcome this fear, as Trent Horn shows in the newly revised and expanded second edition of Persuasive Pro-Life. With a little knowledge and a few proven techniques, you can become a bold and effective apologist for life. Visit shop.catholic.com to order your copy of Persuasive Pro-Life and never again be afraid to speak up. Also available at good Catholic bookstores. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Hey, the big conference is coming up in September. I haven't talked about it much, but if you're free on the last full weekend of September each year, we do our big apologetics conference. And this year we're doing it on the parables, the sayings, the conversations of Jesus himself. And a great opportunity to talk about the Lord, to talk about how he talked. And that can give us so much instruction on how we might approach our conversations today. And I mean, try to beat it. You got Kimberly Hahn, Scott Hahn, Father Sebastian Walsh will be there. Dr. Billy Junker will be there. All of our apologists will be there. We'll do the radio show there. We just have a great time. Check it out. It's, as I said, the last full weekend of September right here in sunny San Diego. CatholicAnswersConference.com is the place to go. CatholicAnswersConference.com. Our guest this hour is J.D. Flynn, canon lawyer and co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Pillar, which you can find at pillarcatholic.com. I think you were checking on the break to see how the story about Father Justin did relative to your other stories.
How did we do? Pretty good. I will say there was a pretty high level of interest in our Father Justin coverage for sure.
All right. Well, thank you for the fair coverage.
Well, it was good to just talk with John. I just wanted to let him sort of put the Catholic Answers out, and I'm glad we were able to do that.
Well, one thing about John, I got to tell you, is he was the most humble person about that. Like, we'd say, somebody would give some criticism, and sometimes the criticisms were a little over the top, but John would say, well, that's good data for us. That's good information. That'll help us make it better. He'd be like, aren't you going to be mad at anybody, John? Nope, he wasn't. I did want to ask you about, did you see, everybody seems to be talking about that AP story on Catholics.
Yeah.
All right, secular press reporting on Catholics. I have my antenna up for what are they going to say? But I don't know. What did you think about the big AP story that came out?
I thought it was pretty fair. So this was a story maybe a week ago that kind of looked at the sort of some trends as the AP understood them, the Associated Press understood them in the life of the church in the United States, and basically said, look, among this ain't your sort of grandma's felt banner church anymore, that young people are more. And then it kind of conflated. It definitely could say young people are not the progressives of the 70s and 80s, but it couldn't quite say exactly what they were. And part of the way you could tell that is it sort of conflated lots of different sort of ecclesial movements and threads. So it was like the traditionalist group Focus. And if you know anything about Focus, they're like, this is a movement sort of born out of a bunch of Steubenville graduates who are pretty, you know, themselves sort of charismatic and evangelizing in that way. And to call them traditionalists just says, okay, these guys didn't quite understand it. So I think there were a lot of ways in which it didn't quite get the nuances of some, I think, important sort of trends emerging in the life of the church today. But the big picture, which is that younger people are more desirous of orthodoxy, with a couple of different expressions, I think it got right. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I sometimes feel that this idea of conservative and liberal is a lens that we just can't stop looking through. And I almost wonder, is there such a thing as a Catholic who could neither be categorized as liberal nor conservative? And I don't know that there is, because for the AP, any normal Catholic is going to be very conservative to them, because Catholic is going to believe things, for example, about human sexuality that seem wacky right wing to the AP. So that lens gets very tiring.
Yeah, but at the same time, Catholics who hold the teachings of the church are going to hold what the church has said since Leo the 13th about like the rights of workers, and that corporations exist for the good of their employees and, you know, for human flourishing, and that governments have an obligation. So Catholics who hold the teachings of the church across the board are going to hold these kind of like ideas that make them seem like righties and ideas that make them seem like lefties. And I think we in America just want to say like, okay, but which ones are they really? And it helps me a lot. You know, one of the good things that I really appreciate about our work is that we get to know Catholics from all around the world. And as I've gotten to know a lot of Catholics from sub-Saharan Africa, it helps me a lot to see, okay, these guys hold the teachings of the church, but in a completely different context where, you know, they're in many regards, in many of their societies, they're often viewed as like kind of dangerously progressive because their societies are very, very politically conservative in some ways. So it's all, you know, those kinds of labels are not particularly effective, I think, at describing what's true about Catholics or what isn't. You know, the most important question is, do we hold and live the teachings of the Catholic Church?
Right. That's exactly right. And I'd like you said about Focus, the story is maybe a little more complex than you could do by just taking a dip. I mean, one of the problems, I think, with media reporting, you know, secular media reporting on the Catholic Church is, you know, we check in every few years. There's not regular reporting that can give you a sense of the richness of Catholic life.
And I have to say, I spend every day of my life reporting on the Catholic Church, and I think I'm missing huge spots of Catholic life. Yeah. Like, I wish I had a newsroom of 100 people, because I'd love to cover lots of elements of the life of the church in depth and seriously and really well. And so then outlets make a choice. Either they sort of deep dive on a few things, or they cover everything at surface level. And we've chosen, for the most part, to kind of deep dive on a few things and to make that kind of our MO. But lots of other outfits have kind of chosen to cover everything at a surface level. But boy, do I wish that we had the resources to cover lots of elements of the life in the church in the United States with a lot of depth.
Well, people can just go to pillarcatholic.com and become supporting members. They can.
Yeah, that would be great.
I don't know if they know that.
We'd have more. We're just hiring. We're just bringing on a Rome correspondent, which I'm super excited about, because, as you can imagine, there's a lot to cover
in Rome?
And soberly in Rome.
Really?
So I'm very excited about that. But yeah.
All right, let's get a caller on here. Kenny's in New York City. New York City! Watching on YouTube. Kenny, go ahead with your question for J.D. Flynn.
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me?
Very well, yes. You don't have a New York accent at all.
Hello. Yes, Dr. Lucifer possessed me. The Pope smokes dope. Allahu Akbar.
I'm tempted to say that might not have been a serious call. I'm pretty thick on these things, but I think that might not have been a serious
call. But what I want to give Kenny credit for is he stayed on hold for a pretty long time to offer that brilliant observation.
Good for you, Kenny. Good for you. You're a real soldier for the cause, Kenny. Good for you. Right. You're not a quitter. The number here is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Okay, well, you know, I just said that thing that I said about liberals and conservatives, but the man whose name is unpronounceable, I don't know if anybody knows how you're supposed to pronounce Ross Douthat's last name. Is that do you think that's a rough approximation?
I think you did it, yeah.
Do you think I did it? Yeah. All right.
I did.
He says liberals and conservative Catholics. Did you see that article in the New York Times? We just need to get used to living with one another because neither of us is going away. I'm not exactly sure.
I don't think I did see that, but that's true. I suppose that's true.
It's not bad. Yes. Like, that's not a bad thing. Like, the church is not supposed to be some exclusive club that you have to have a particular political view to be in.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, obviously it's not new for there to be a broad spectrum of political ideas among practicing Catholics. And there's room. There's room in the life of, you know, in the teachings of the church for a panoply of a broad spectrum of political ideas within a framework, right? So there are certain things which we know to be true. And I think the extremism of politics today makes it harder. I mean, it is very difficult for a Catholic to make a judgment about who they would vote for if they were looking for someone who supports the dignity of human life from conception to natural death, because the extremism on the culture of death in both of the major parties in America make that impossible. And so I think we're probably in new sort of voting territory for American Catholics, but there's room, I think, in theory at least, for a broad spectrum of sort of political ideas within the framework of Catholicism.
The number 888-318-7884, J.D. Flynn, our guest, the editor-in-chief of The Pillar. We're talking about the church in the news. If you've got questions or if you just want to share a comment and have J.D. Give his response, you're very welcome here. If you've got a story that you've been paying attention to that you'd like to know what J.D. thinks about from his exposure to the church in the news, you are welcome. 888-318-7884. We're going to take a very quick break. We'll come back with more calls for J.D. Flynn on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City. And you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Turn to Mary, the Mother of God, for help bearing witness to the gift of life with the National Life Rosary. Designed exclusively for EWTN, the unique centerpiece and crucifix represent the reality that all life is sacred and begins at conception. Help build a culture of life with the National Life Rosary. Available now at EWTNRC.com. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Hey, second hour, Father Sebastian Walsh is going to be here, and we're going to talk about tell me how to say it. Dignitas infinita?
Dignitas infinita.
Okay.
I would say infinita.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you there. I mean, while we're bringing that up, I mean, is Pope Francis, is his pontificate hard to cover? And I mean it in this way, that no matter what you say, you're going to make almost everybody mad. like this just seems like everybody's mad about, you know, if you say one thing, people are mad. Say the other thing, people are mad. I don't know.
The good news is We try not to have takes on Pope Francis. We try to just explain what it is that he's trying to say, which does make everybody mad.
Yeah.
I mean, it does make everybody mad.
Because then people are like, why didn't you have a take?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. But with Dignitas Infinita, it was kind of – it's interesting because by a lot of accounts, it's a very, very good document, a very clear document that affirms a lot of elements of the teaching of the church. But the framing of it was very interesting from the Vatican because, you know, last year, right around Christmas time, Fiducia Supplicans came out, which had to do with blessings for same-sex couples, and a lot of people were very displeased about that. And right after it, Cardinal Fernandez, the prefect of the CDF, said, well, listen, if you didn't like that document, we've got another one coming that you're really going to love. It was like, listen, there are people who like that one, but if you weren't in that camp, we got something for you. I know you're going to love it. It's going to be great. So it's just kind of funny how they're sort of the Holy See probably knows too what the segments of practicing Catholics are and what they're looking for and that sort of thing. So
is the Holy See terrible at media, or is that are they terrible at media?
It's I say that as a criticism in love.
Sure.
The Dicastery for Communications is the most has the biggest budget of any department of the Vatican. So the CDF doesn't have a bigger budget. The Congregation for Bishops doesn't have a bigger budget. I suppose the Secretary of State does because their budget's not consolidated. It's broken up into parts. But the Dicastery for Communications has a big, big, big budget. And what they do for that is effectively not answer questions from reporters, not clarify questions that arise, and periodically make these big media faux pas. So there's been a promise to sort of professionalize over time, and there's some good professionals who work there to be sure, but there's been a promise to sort of modernize and streamline a lot of the ways that they engage with media, and it just sort of hasn't manifested. So, you know, when you're covering a story about the Vatican, you always write to the Holy See for comment, but to be honest, they don't even acknowledge those requests, and they sort of don't. They could be much more proactive with media in a way that would allow them to, I think, get fairer coverage, but it's just not – whatever they're doing with that money, that's not a priority for them.
Pope Francis is obviously kind of exciting to the media. Like, he's very – he's great news. He's great copy, so to speak.
He was. I think there's a very honestly a kind of Francis fatigue effect.
Okay.
Because what has happened now is like sort of everyone knows that the Pope will be on an airplane and say something controversial, and then there will be this sort of flare up effect of it. And at least in Catholic media, I know there's sort of like an increasing like frustration with a cycle that feels like the Pope will say something that's controversial. There will be a great deal of sort of secular coverage of it. There will be an expectation that Catholic media kind of clarify it, and then the Pope will maybe kind of walk it back or clarify it. But that cycle just kind of comes and comes and comes. So there's to some extent a kind of fatigue there. And you know, the Pope does not as often preach anymore at large masses or release daily mass homilies and things like that. So the sort of ongoing catechesis that people look to in papal coverage is a little bit less present, and then there's just these sort of controversial things that come up. So.
Well, he seems to we had Pope John Paul II, who clearly he remained Pope through his declining years all the way to death. Pope Benedict did not do that. I don't know what the current Pope's intention is, but he's certainly much more frail than he was when he started. And
he is. If you see the Pope in person, he is much more frail. He's lost a lot of weight. His gait is very fragile. And one story that I think has gone undercovered in the life of the church is that for the past couple of years, the Pope has refrained from publicly serving as a celebrant for liturgies, from publicly celebrating masses. And so people wonder if that's a sign of the profundity of his health problems or something like that. He's concerned that he wouldn't be able to sustain the celebration of the Mass. JP2, if you remember, celebrated masses from a chair, a kind of modified wheelchair in the last years of his pontificate. And so the question is, maybe Pope Francis doesn't feel as comfortable with that as an option, or maybe he is concerned about his mobility in some way, but he has not celebrated publicly been the celebrant for masses. I think even at the funeral of Benedict XVI last January, he sat in choir, which is to say he sat in a cassock and surplice and probably a cope, but he wasn't the principal celebrant. And so that, I think, bespeaks a probably for a priest, that's a serious thing. So I think bespeaks probably a pretty serious set of health issues.
So is it unseemly then? You feel like it's unseemly, but people are going to start talking about the next pope now. I mean, once the pope starts to show signs of his age, I guess would be the way to say it. I mean, he's 87, I think. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, people live to 100.
No, I think it's natural. Yeah. With an 87, if there's been an 87-year-old person in your family's eye, you know that it's the sort of thing where they could go very quickly and the family wouldn't be surprised, or they could live for another 10 years and the family wouldn't be surprised. It's just the sort of unpredictability of that stage of life. But I do think it's natural that people start to wonder and have conversations about, okay, where is the church going, and what will the cardinals look for, and who will be the next pope, and what will people look for in the criteria of the next pope? And certainly those discussions are happening. Cardinals are not supposed to kind of collude together ahead of a conclave or make agreements together about how they'll vote or those kinds of things. But they certainly have discussions about what they think the church needs in the next pope. And we know those conversations are going on now among cardinals in Rome and then cardinals in other parts of the world as well.
When you look at the makeup of the College of Cardinals, I mean, how long has the pope been pope? Is he coming up on? It's past 10 years now, right?
A little more than 10 years, yeah. So he celebrated his 10th in 2023.
So does that mean he's appointed or he's named most of the cardinals in the college?
Yeah, so at this point, we did some data reporting on this. I could look for it, but I can tell you sort of off the top of my head that at this point the Pope has appointed, I think, about two-thirds of the voting cardinals. And so he has, to be sure, sort of shaped the College of Cardinals in his according to his own judgment. Now, what's interesting about that, though, is that the Pope has chosen cardinals from parts of the world that are not sort of typically cardinalatial sees. You know, for example, in the United States, we can think of Cardinal Joseph Tobin, who was actually the Archbishop of Indianapolis when he was created a cardinal and then moved to the Archdiocese of Newark. But
our cardinal here in San Diego, we've never had a cardinal.
Your cardinal in San Diego, that's another great example. San Diego is not a place that typically has a cardinal. So, you know, whether it's Indiana or whether it's Mongolia, the Pope has chosen sort of far-flung places from which to appoint cardinals from the perspective of the Holy See. And in some cases, it seems he knows them well. He certainly knows Cardinal Tobin well, but in other places, it seems that the Pope has chosen them because they lead these far-flung sees, or sometimes there are churches that are persecuted or things like that. So it's not clear, very honestly, how well the Pope sort of knows all of the people who he has appointed as cardinals, or whether it was their personal characteristics that led him to appoint them, or just their geographic locales. And so that could create, I think, a lot of unexpected coalitions, or a lot of unexpected sort of voting trends in the conclave. Now, we won't ever get a really good breakdown of that because the conclave proceedings are secret, but I do think even while the Pope has appointed the majority of the voting cardinals, that doesn't tell us a whole lot, or it doesn't tell us as much about sort of their theological disposition as you might think.
So when you add it all up, what you know and what you've seen in your reporting, who's going to be the next Pope? Just tell me now.
Well, if I tell you now, then I won't.
I don't care.
I laid down some money on that. What I actually did say is to just check my own suspicions about that. I was recently talking with this AI priest, and I asked.
Knock it off! That's not. Come on, give me. All right, I just want odds. I'll throw out some cardinals. You give me odds on them. Let's start with the guy in Mongolia. What's the chances we finally, after 2,000 years of waiting, finally get a Mongolian?
Yeah, it's time.
Pope.
And especially
if
you've had Mongolian barbecue, or if you like horses, you know that Mongolia has a lot to offer the world.
By the way, when you say like horses, you mean to ride them, because you said barbecue
them,
and then horses.
Those are separate ideas.
Yeah, I just want to make clear we're not having a special moment here of your that you're going to hear about later. But all right, yeah, so
although you know that in some parts of Italy, horses are a delicacy. Like in northern Italy, horses are it's a pretty common sort of delicacy.
I did
but that's
not that.
Here nor there, I suppose. Yeah.
No,
it's quite good.
In some parts of the U.S., they shoot dogs. At least I heard that recently. But you didn't give me a percentage shot. What are the odds on finally getting a Mongolian Pope?
Let's put him in the sort of 5% category.
5%. That's pretty good. A 1 in 20 chance that we get a Mongolian
That's
pope.
Low.
I'm going to take care of my health because I want to be around to see that.
We definitely won't get a Mongolian pope because the cardinal of Mongolia is an Italian. So I suppose we definitely won't get a Mongolian as such to be pope. But
I hope he's not a northern Italian. We don't want him around all those horses in Mongolia if he's from northern Italy. But is there any – like I know people do the handicap. You probably go to London and bet – on who, like, you could probably put money down today on who the next pope
would be. Oh, yeah, you could. And the people whom people expect is Cardinal Tagle, who works in the Vatican Curia.
Philippine?
Before that, the Archbishop of Manila.
Okay.
People say that he's a front runner. People, there are a couple of Italian cardinals who people say. Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Secretary of State, is increasingly someone who seems to be talked about in those conversations. I think Cardinal Ike of the Netherlands is someone who's frequently mentioned as at least possibly papabile, as they say. So, people are – those things are beginning to trickle out. Cardinal Zuppi is another kind of common name which comes up. He's an Italian who's kind of
– I feel like somebody mentioned a Hungarian.
There was a while where the Archbishop of Budapest, Cardinal Peter Erdo, was frequently talked about as a strong candidate for the papacy. I don't know if he's still – I don't hear his name as often in discussions these days. But I think among the – again, we talk about the limits of kind of conservative and liberal labels. But among the sort of – maybe we could say communio theological school, Cardinal Erdo has been regarded as one of the stronger possible candidates.
I'm so grateful that you'll talk about this with me. I kind of thought you were like, no, I'm not talking about that. That's unseen.
No, why not? I mean, what do I have to lose?
But it's just part of. But then the thing is, you know, you could kind of narrow it down, and then the Pope goes another 10 years. You just never, and it'll be a whole different cast of characters.
And at any time, conclaves are so tricky. Nobody really expected Wojtyła. Not a lot of people expect. In the 2013 conclave, when Bergoglio was elected and became Pope Francis, the expectation was that Cardinal Angelo Scola of Venice was a lock. I mean, everyone sort of thought that he was a lock because he seemed to be at least the preference of Benedict XVI, and he was known to have been very close with Benedict, and it seemed that he would be the clear and obvious front runner. And what happened, Sai, is that right before the conclave, there was a news story in Italy that tied him loosely, that suggested that Cardinal Scola had some associations with some corrupt Italian politicians. And the cardinals went into conclave and they didn't know how big of a story this was going to be, or kind of whether or not they would come out and this story would have blown up and become something much bigger. And so there was concern about electing Cardinal Scola precisely because of that. Now, it turned out to be kind of nothing, a little nothing burger of a story. But because they don't have phones or the internet or newspapers or anything in the conclave, they didn't know that. And so that really impacted their voting choices.
Are there places where a new pope can't come from? Like, I wonder, could an American be a pope? Could a German? Or are there places where it's like, no,
there's a lot of conventional wisdom that says that an American will not be elected pope. But I don't know about that. I think the right American. It all has to do with what the College of Cardinals thinks the Church needs, and who they see that, and the extent to which they know each other. One challenge right now for the College of Cardinals is there have been very few consistories in Rome, gatherings of cardinals, and so they don't really know each other as well. And so the sort of first few days of the before the conclave will be critical for them to get to know each other. And the rules of voting have changed a little bit to kind of favor the front runners. There are more votes at the beginning than there once were, and that allows for less discussion inside the conclave. And so that sort of lends towards people who have big names, even among the College of Cardinals. So I don't know, under those circumstances, it's possible that an American could be elected pope. I think, you know, one common misconception that's worth understanding is that I think people commonly perceive that the Holy Spirit chooses the Pope. And the Holy Spirit certainly guides the Church, but the Church doesn't teach that the Holy Spirit chooses the Pope, rather that the cardinals make a prudential judgment of their own accord.
All right. Well, I am so grateful that you took the time with us. I'm really glad that you had that conversation with me. It's nice to get a little behind the scenes with a journalist who knows what's going on in the world to get the take. And a 5% chance on a Mongolian makes me pretty happy. Thanks, J.D. Flynn.
Well, that was great. Good talking to you, Si. Thanks for having me.
J.D. Flynn, you can find his work and the work of his colleagues over at The Pillar. You go to pillarcatholic.com. Do go to pillarcatholic.com. Put it, make it one of your news sources. It'll make a big difference for you. Coming up, we're going to talk about Dignitas Infinita with Father Sebastian Walsh. Please hang on, and we'll do that.